temple, Jack said. She looks like a little skunk compared to y'all. Mais oui, y'all are gonna bump old Shirley's name right off the marquee. Carol was the first to hear about the Shirley Temple look-alike contest because her father owns the Bob, one of the two movie theaters in Thornton. Mr. Bob also owns the Bob in Royalton and the Bob in Rayville, both down the road. His biggest movie theater is in New Orleans, the Robea. It's the fanciest of all the Bob theaters in the world. A month ago, it was formally announced that the Bob would sponsor the contest with a Shirley Temple man coming all the way from Hollywood. The girl who wins the contest gets to go down to New Orleans on the train and represent our town in the statewide Shirley Temple look-alike contest. And that girl also gets to stay at the Pontchartrain Hotel and be treated like a princess the whole entire time. Girls just came out of the woodwork. Even some little colored girls tried to sign up, but the contest rules say only white girls could apply. It costs a dime to sign up, but Mr. Bob let some girls sign up without paying. Some people who came to the Bob today paid him with eggs or potatoes. All those 8 Nugent kids get to come to the Betty Boop Club Saturday matinee by paying with 1 bushel of collard greens. Genevieve had her dressmaker, Cecile, do up all our costumes. I have the doll in this little blue and white plaid dress with a little red tie that fits me to a T. Over it, I'm wearing a matching little blue coat and a black cap, just like the outfit Shirley wore when she sang Good Ship Lollipop. I modeled it for Father last night, and when he saw me, he said, "Come on over here and give your father a hug." He doesn't usually like to be hugged when he gets home, so I was surprised. I went and wrapped my arms around him, and then he gave me a $2 bill. Carol's outfit is so spiffy. She has a little brown leather jacket that she borrowed from her brother, and she's wearing it over a pair of baggy dungarees with an aviator cap on her head, just like Shirley wore when she met Loop's plane in Bright Eyes. Oh, Carol is so beautiful. All my friends are beautiful. Niecy has a bright yellow coat and a white tam over her curls. And that teensy, she has a pink ballet tutu like Shirley got for her birthday in that movie. I secretly think that I look the most like Shirley Temple. After all, I am the one with the blonde hair. But I wouldn't dare tell anybody this. When Genevieve brought us to the theater this afternoon, they made us check in at the door while a lady gave each one of us a piece of cardboard to hang around our necks on a string. The cardboard has our official contest numbers written on them. Mine is 39, Carol's is 40, Tinksy's is 41, and somehow things got mixed up because Niecy is number 61. I hate this cardboard hanging around my neck. It covers up the buttons on my little blue coat. A Shirley Temple look-alike judge spends his whole life riding trains all over the country judging who looks like Shirley Temple and who doesn't. His name is Mr. Lance Lacey, but Carol just calls him Mr. Hollywood. He arrived yesterday, and Carol and her mother and father went to meet him at the train station. They took him back to Carol's house, and he changed out of his suit into a powder blue shirt and loose baggy pants that Carol said looked like pajamas. During supper, he received 3 long-distance calls. We don't get 3 long-distance calls in a month at our house. They all sat there, Carol and her parents, and Lowell and Bobby, her brothers, just waiting for Mr. Hollywood to get off the phone so they could finish eating. Then this morning, he got another long-distance call before breakfast. I have always, always wanted to be up on the stage of the Bob, and now here I am. Oh, I was meant to be a star. Standing up in front of the footlights, high above the audience. Lights, lights, lights. It's better than Christmas. It's hard to see out into the audience, but I can tell exactly where my brother Pete is sitting because he yelled out, "Hey, Stinky!" I want to step out in front of all these other little ringlet-headed girls and break into a dance. Make everyone look at me. Only me. But you have to stand in line. All we're supposed to do is stand up here and try to look like Shirley Temple. I hate it when I have so many other talents. I can sing, dance, spell prestidigitation, recite the Ancient Mariner, whistle, and act out stories I made up myself. These folks don't know what they are missing. Mr. Hollywood's voice flows out all velvet from the microphone. Shirley Temple represents what is best about America, he says. Her innocence and smile are a ray of sunshine that beams across these 48 states. And when times look down and regular Joes have trouble buying a cup of coffee, Shirley's dimples can cheer up even the saddest depression hobo. Little Miss Sunshine has danced her way into the hearts of millions, lifting up our land with her unique brand of sweetness. He glances back at us girls for a second and then gestures our way. Now it is my pleasure to be in your fine town and look over your crop of little girls. It's my job to judge which of these young ladies comes closest to Shirley Temple's wholesome charm and innocence. Which of them is adorable enough to cheer up this great nation of ours like America's sweetheart? Oh, if only they would let me show my real talent, I could cheer up this nation. I would tell my story about Alligator Girl with the head and shoulders of a girl and the rest of her body pure alligator, kind of like a mermaid, but mean. Oh, I am the world's best scary storyteller. If I could only strut my stuff, I would not only win this contest, but I'd win the one in New Orleans, too. I would get my own private rail car with my own bathtub in it and velvet curtains, and then I'd invite Caro and Teensy and Niecy to come with me on my trip around America. We'd go to Washington, D.C., where the President and Mrs. Roosevelt would be waiting, begging me to come have tomato sandwiches with the crust cut off. I'd tell them this Great Depression has gone on too long, and I'll give them my ideas on how to help the poor folks at Ollie Trot's Trailer Paradise who lost their real homes. Oh, I'll wave to everybody, and they will forget Shirley Temple ever existed. Mr. Hollywood turns to us with his hands up to his mouth, stretching out his lips. Has he hurt his lips? No. He is trying to make us smile wider. He gives a signal to the piano player who starts playing On the Good Ship Lollipop. Then he circles around us and stops at one girl who's wearing a fuzzy white fur coat. He makes her turn in a circle. Then he writes something down on his clipboard. He doesn't say a word, just sort of examines her like you do a horse. My mouth is starting to hurt from all this smiling, I whispered to Teensy. Then I don't have the slightest idea in the world what gets into her, but she hauls off and steps on my toe. So I step right back on her toe and grind down a little. Ouch! Teensy hollers. She loves stuff like this. It's what keeps her going. She turns around at one of the other little girls and sticks her tongue out. Well, that makes that little sissy start crying. Titty baby, little sissy titty baby, Teensy whispers. Then out of nowhere, nowhere at all, Teensy poots. One of the biggest poots you have ever heard. You would not think that a poot that big would come out of a girl that small. The look on her face is shocked. She looks behind her like she can't believe she did it, like when our dog poots and it scares him. All the other girls heard it, though, and they back away from us, like Teensy's poot is alive and might knock 'em down or crawl all over 'em. Teensy and I start laughing, and we cannot stop. If you know of something funnier than pootin', then I wish you'd tell me about it. Mr. Hollywood himself must not have heard the actual poot. He's still on the other side of the stage, still examining girls. But when he hears us laughing, he looks over our way, and I can see his lips moving, mouthing the words, "Be quiet." Well, that makes us laugh even harder, and Carol and Niecy start cracking up, too. "Shh," Mr. Hollywood signals, his shh finger in front of his mouth. Then he takes that same finger and uses it at the corner of his lips to make a big smile, trying to make us do the same thing. The sight of Mr. Hollywood smiling like that just pushes us over the edge, and we start howling, the kind of laughing that makes our mothers send us outdoors. Then all of a sudden, Mr. Hollywood turns on his fancy heels and heads our way. By this point, there is no stopping us. We couldn't stop laughing even if we wanted to. Mr. Hollywood stops right in front of us. "Pipe down this very instant," he says. His eyes are popping out and his mouth is wide open, and we can see that he has not one, not two, but three rotten brown teeth. The front ones are shiny white, but those back ones are rotted. This just makes us scream with laughter. When we don't quiet down, he throws his clipboard, slam-bam, right on the stage floor and takes a step toward us, and for a second, I think he's gonna hit us. But then he changes his mind. He signals to the piano player to play a little softer. Then old Rotted Teeth steps up to the microphone and says, "Some of our would-be Shirleys seem to think something is very funny. Numbers 39, 40, 41, and 61, would you please step over here to the microphone?" When we get over to the microphone stand, Pete yells out, "It's Stinky!" I throw a kiss out to the audience. Mr. Hollywood Rottooth looks at us and smiles this big old fake grin. "Girls, since you know something so funny, I want you to tell it to the rest of us." The four of us look at each other. Then Carol steps closer to the microphone. She reaches up and takes the aviator cap off and holds it down at her side. Her hair is flat as a rug. "Do you really want to know what is so funny?" she says into the microphone. Mr. Hollywood leans into the microphone and says, "Yes, number 40, we do." "Well, okay," Caro says, and looks straight out into the audience. She opens her mouth and says loud and clear, "Teensy farted." Well, the whole theater just busts its seams. They start laughing and hooting, and a whole gang of them up front, led by my brother, I bet, starts making poot noises with the hands, and pretty soon other sections of the theater join in, making the same noise, until it sounds like we're in one giant theater full of pooters. The few that aren't making poot sounds are screaming out things like, "Yay, Teensy!" All the other contestants have clumped together at the back of the stage. I am laughing so hard I can hardly breathe. Mr. Hollywood shakes his clipboard in Carol's face and booms into the microphone. "What are your names, little girls? Girls number 39, 40, 41, 61, give me your names immediately." We just stare back at him. It is so much fun to see a grown-up get this mad. "I said, tell me your Christian names." I'm still dying to talk into the microphone all by myself, so I take a step forward. I take a deep breath and give a big smile to the audience. "My name," I announce, "is Pooty Pootwell." The whole audience breaks into applause. For me! Waves of applause just wash up on the stage and crash against my new shoes. I knew they would love me if I had half a chance. Old Mr. Hollyrot pushes me away and leans into the microphone. "All four of you are disqualified. Do you hear me? Disqualified." His hands are shaking so hard he can hardly hold his clipboard. His mouth is all pinched together and the veins in his face are about to pop. all because of me. The place is going completely wild. Popcorn flying all over the place, juju bees landing on stage, and a group of boys standing up yelling, "Go Pootie!" Ushers are running up and down the aisles trying to make kids stop throwing their Coca-Cola cups in the air. They're yelling, "We want Pootie! We want Pootie!" and climbing over seats and stomping on the floor. It's wonderful! The other little girls are crying and calling for their mothers. Some of the mothers rush up to the stage. You can hear them saying to us, "You should be ashamed of yourselves." But I am not ashamed at all. The whole theater is going mad, and it's all because of me. "Bring down the curtains," Mr. Hollerot says into the microphone. And then Mr. Bob is at the microphone saying, "All right now, boys and girls, pipe down. I know you're a little stirred up, but I got a special treat for you. Listen up now. Who wants to see an extra installment of Flash Gordon? If you all will settle back down, I'll show you a special, unplanned screening of next week's installment, Flash Gordon and the Planet of Mongo." He signals to the piano player, who starts playing something soothing. The popcorn stops flying, and kids start back to their seats. When you mention Planet Mongo around here, people shut up and listen. Then Mrs. Bob steps up to the microphone and says, "Mothers, would you please come out and get your daughters? And those of you girls whose mothers aren't here, please come on back to the dressing room with me. Everything is just fine." Teensy and Caro and Niecy and I start to walk off the stage, but Teensy cannot stand it. She runs back to the center of the stage, turns, and sticks her little booty out at the audience and wiggles it for all she's worth. Well, Mr. Lance Toothrot Lacey storms over to Teensy and yanks her arm so hard he just about pulls it off. And there he is, leaning Teensy over his knee with his hand in the air, about to give her a spanking right on her tiny little behind. But Mr. Bob stops him. "Son, I think you better watch your manners. This child doesn't belong to you." "I don't care who the hell she belongs to," Mr. Rotten Teeth says. "She has ruined the official Shirley Temple look-alike contest. This has never happened to me before." Old Hollywood's voice has changed. He doesn't sound like a movie star with a velvet curtain voice anymore, but like one of those fellas who come to town with the circus and spit out the sides of their mouth.
"Well, that might be true, son," Mr. Bob says, "but you still don't take a hand to one of our daughters. Her own father can spank her if he sees fit."
Mr. Hollywood straightens his ascot and pulls down the cuffs of his sleeves.
"Well, I'm glad you're the one who runs a hick movie house in this hick town with that bunch of underage hick vixens. I'm on the next train out of here."
And then he turns to leave, but not before Mr. Bob says,
"I'll be sure and call your 20th Century Fox pals and let them know you're on your way. When they ask me who won the contest, I'll just tell them our gals were too pretty to pick just one."
Genevieve is standing backstage holding our coats, and oh, she looks mad.
"Que machon, Teensy," she says. "You went too far with that last little butt shake. Que fais-tu d'embarrasse?"
Genevieve pushes open the stage door, and we step outside in the cold, fresh air. Jack is there to meet us, blowing on his fingers, stomping his feet, and laughing.
"Go, Pooties," he says. "Garnet Parish Pooties are the best."
"We are temples of the Holy Spirit," I say. And we all crack up again.
"That is enough," Genevieve says. "I am taking you girls home. Jack, please go find Mr. Bob and Mrs. Bob and let them know that we'll be over at their house later."
"Yes, ma'am," Jack says, and turns to go, but not before he gives me a wink and hands me a box of juju bees. Ah, I like that, Jack. Our curls are gone. All 168 of them. Genevieve brushed them out, hard. At Carol's house, the four of us are standing in the living room. Mr. Bob is in his easy chair. Mrs. Bob is sitting in her rocker.
Bob, Genevieve says, I want you to give these girls their punishment.
For the first time, I get scared.
Girls, Mr. Bob says, I have thought about this long and hard. The four of you, well, the four of you behave simply terribly in my public theater. You ruin the day for a lot of little girls, and their mothers, too. I'm not going to hear the end of it. They've already been ringing my phone off the hook.
Genevieve says, Think of les petites pauvres. Y'all ruined it for the poor children. Nothing to eat but onions and turnips in months, no? Some of them, pears, haven't had a job in 2-3 years. Sharecropper enfants come to town once a week for to see Flash Gordon. They don't want to see your derrière fille. Comprendez-vous? You show those poor little girls the respect.
I look at Genevieve because she always makes me think things I want to forget about.
Genevieve's right, Mr. Bob says. There is a depression going on in this country, even if you four princesses don't see it.
One of these days, you girls have got to stop behaving like ladies, Mrs. Bob says. You're not babies anymore. You are young ladies. And there is a right way and a wrong way to act. What you did today was definitely wrong. You don't want to get reputations for being bad girls, do you?
But, Mrs. Bob, I say, before I can stop myself, it's so much fun being a bad girl.
Vivi, she says, do you want me to call your mother and father and have them talk to you instead of me?
No, I don't want her to call my mother, and definitely not my father, because he doesn't talk. He just takes off his belt and lets it do his talking for him. No, ma'am, I say.
You all have got to start acting like ladies if you expect to get along in this town, Mrs. Bob says. How could I get that through your head, Carol?
But, Mama, Carol says, we can't help it if Teensy pooted.
I know, Mrs. Bob says. You can't fight Mother Nature, but the four of you couldn't just leave it at that.
I drop my head, but I'm secretly thinking about how very original the name Pooty Pootwell is.
Thought I was going to have to call out for help, Mr. Bob says. Never in my life have I had that much trouble trying to calm a theater down. Y'all are not going to get away with this scot-free. For the next month, that is 4 straight Saturdays. You bad little girls are going to clean up the Bob after the Saturday matinee. Y'all are going to sweep up every single piece of popcorn and pick up every candy wrapper that's left on the floor. Furthermore, you will not be allowed into the Bob except to clean. No movies during the whole time of your punishment. And I'm going to talk to Mr. Hyde over at the Paramount, too. Ask him to give his ticket people and his ushers strict instructions not to let the four of you into his theater, either. Not until the month is up.
Back home in my bedroom, I sit down and think about what all has happened. And the more I think about it, the madder I get. It is also unfair. I get so mad that my brain squeezes together and pushes out the most brilliant idea of my life to date. I will start my very own newspaper where I can print nothing but the truth. The name of my newspaper comes to me in a flash. It will be called Vivi's Very Important News. V-V-I-N for short. Pronounced Vivin. I sharpen a pencil, get out my Big Chief tablet, and just start writing. I must reveal the news of this terrible injustice.
Chapter 8. In spite of the light drizzle that evening, Sitta was possessed with the idea of building a fire at the edge of the lake. She hadn't built an outdoor fire since she was a 9-year-old Girl Scout. The year Vivi and Nisi had led Troop 55 and backed into the flagpole with Nisi's country squire station wagon. She toyed with the twigs and newspapers, used up 8 kitchen matches, and blew until she was hyperventilating. Then she gave up, sat back on her feet, and felt foolish. She only required a small fire. She wasn't cold. It's not that she needed heat. She had no plans to cook anything over the flames. She simply wanted to build a little fire outdoors and watch it burn. Her incompetence made her feel out of place in the Great Northwest. She missed the screeching urban comfort of Manhattan. If her mother were here, she'd have built a fabulous fire. Mama or Caro. Nights at Spring Creek, they'd build fires for hot dogs, s'mores, maybe toss in a firecracker or two. They'd sing, tell ghost stories, host talent shows, and compete in limbo contests, that broom lowering till it all but touched the pine needles. Later, their skin coated with 612, the kids would lean back against their mother's bodies and watch the flames of the fire and the citronella candles burning and the smoke curling up from the mosquito coils.
"Piney pitch is the secret to starting a fire," Vivi used to say, "unless you have kerosene, of course."
Sitta hadn't thought she even remembered that instruction.
"Get hard pitchwood from the center of a loblolly pine stump if you can find it, Sitta, and you can't go wrong."
Well, Mama, there aren't any loblolly pines around this place. She stood up and looked around her. All around her were Sitka spruce, western red cedar, and hemlock, but she didn't know which was which. She had never thought much about trees before, except for the old live oak tree at Pecan Grove with its 120-foot branch spread. That tree could make any member of her family weep when they talked about it. When Sitta was a girl, she believed if she ever got married, it would be under that tree. Pitch, Sitta thought. I'm looking for pitch. Perfect pitch. There was no perfect pitch, but Sitta did find a rotting stump. Not 5 feet from where she had been squatting. She looked into the center of it, and there was the resiny part, the last part to rot. Reaching into the trunk, she broke off several pieces and returned to her erstwhile fire site.
"Separate your sticks, Sitta Lee," she heard her mother, or Caro, say. "Start with a tiny teepee, with the littlest twigs over some shavings. Good. Now use some slightly larger sticks for your next layer. Just keep building it like that. Easy does it, while your fire builds."
Sitta did exactly as her mother had taught her, but the fire would not catch. Everything was simply too wet. It was dark. Only the tiny lights on the other side of the lake were visible. Still a thick cloud cover, no stars visible. And this was supposed to be the time of meteors. May had told her the Olympic Peninsula was known for shooting stars in late summer. Just Sitta's luck to show up the one summer when clouds refused to budge. All this quiet dampness was somewhat spiritual and somewhat depressing. Returning to the cabin, Sitta slipped into a pair of dry, warm sweatpants and lit a fire in the fireplace. She put on a Ricky Lee Jones CD of songs from the 40s, poured herself a glass of brandy, sat down, and tried to make herself read a Jungian book on marriage. 3 pages in, she closed the book. Lying down in front of the fire, she stroked Huey Lean. She could smell the alder logs as their burning warmed the room. Through the glass door, she could see nothing but gray and rain. "This is cozy, all right," Sitta thought, "but if it's like this in August, I hate to think what December looks like." She pulled Huey Lean's travel bed in front of the fireplace. She stared into the flames for a moment, then reached for the book of Divine Secrets. It fell open to a florist card that read, "Happy Anniversary, Yayas. Love from the Yaya Husbands." Wild. But that's the way it was. Every year the Yayas threw themselves a party to celebrate another anniversary of their friendship, and the husbands actually brought gifts. Sitta remembered more about Yaya anniversaries than she did about Vivi and Shep's. A flyer from the grand opening of the Southgate Shopping Center in Thornton was tucked in next to a handwritten recipe for a cheese souffle. The recipe had been crossed out, and a note to the side read, "Forget it, fix a drink, and go out for hamburgers." Next, she ran across a photo of a younger Caro holding an infant in her arms. Caro was making the A-OK sign with her fingers and wore a jaunty little beret. The infant was tucked in the crook of her arms, and they seemed to be standing in front of a statue. Which one of us wild children was that, Sitta wondered. As she turned to the next page, what looked like pieces of walnut shell fell out of the book. Sitta imagined her mother years ago snacking on the nuts while pasting things into the scrapbook. Sitta thought about throwing the remnants away, but changed her mind. Gathering the shards up off the floor, she tucked them back into the book where they had been for God knows how long. Sitta thought about nuts, how they are food and seed at once, how they hold fertility magic in one tight, tiny space. Her mind ran to rich symbolic imaginings, but still she could not guess the enchantment those particular walnut shells contained. As the smells of sweet woodruff and alder burning and lake water wafted about her, so did the essences of her mother's stories. Not in the way Sitta wanted, but in the way of hidden things that mysteriously reveal worlds unsuspected and longed for.
Vivi, 1937. Mother won't let Caro and me play in the new hammock until we rub the face off the Blessed Virgin statue Father brought back from the island of Cuba. This turpentine stinks, Caro says. I don't see why we have to do this.
Rub hard, I say. Then Mama will let us try out the hammock.
The statue is sitting on our front porch, right where it got delivered in a wooden box alongside Father's luggage. Father is just back from Cuba, where he went to the Tennessee Walking Horse Show with his rich friends. He stayed in a big hacienda with servants. Cuba is paradise, Father says, with white beaches and orange flowers growing everywhere, and wild parrots and all the people happy. His rich friends run the whole island, and Father said he will take me with him next time. He said Mother dresses too much like hired help to take her. If Mother would take the kerchief off her head and the dust rags out of her pockets, I just know she'd be beautiful. Father bought the Cuban Blessed Virgin for Mother. The statue was gorgeous with brown skin. She had earrings and a necklace and the brightest colors of any Mother Mary I had ever seen. Big red lips and a violet color on her eyelids like she was ready for a fiesta. Mother just hated her. The first thing Mother did after Father left for the office this morning was to unscrew the gold hoop earrings and take all those pretty red and yellow necklaces off the Virgin's neck and drop them in a pile over by the hen and chicken planter. The whole time she was doing it, she shook her head like that statue had gone and done something bad.
The Blessed Virgin is not a Negro, Mother said. It is just like foreigners to try to turn the Mother of God into a gaudy tart. That statue needs to be cleaned up. Imagine what Father Coughlin would say if he could see this statue.
Mother listens to Father Coughlin on the radio. If Father Coughlin says something, then it's like Moses brought it down from the mountain.
You listen to that radio priest more than you do to your own husband, Father tells her. She says, if demon rum wasn't stalking your soul, then I might listen to you more.
Mother says that Father spends too much time with his horse friends, and he has turned his back on God. Mother will not go to any horse shows with him, so I get to take a place. I love all the ladies in their jodhpurs and boots, and the picnics with vodka gimlets for the grown-ups, and pink lemonade for me, and everyone all dressed up. Father's Tennessee Walking Horses, Passing Fancy, and Rabelais Dream take prizes right and left. Every time those horse people get together, it's a party.
Take your fingers and rub every bit of that color off the Virgin's cheeks, Mother says.
I pour a little more turpentine on my rag and rub in circles to get the rouge off the Virgin's cheeks. After Mama goes inside, we can finally talk about our secret plans. Today is the day leading up to the night of our divine ritual ceremony, which Caro and Tinksy and Niecy and I have been planning and planning.
Do you think Niecy will chicken out? I asked Caro.
She thinks we'll get kidnapped like the Lindbergh baby, Caro says. She is scared to go out in the woods at night.
I go out in the woods by myself at night all the time.
You do not.
Oh, yes, I do. I go out there all the time.
I'm brave as Amelia Earhart. Sometimes I sleep out there by myself.
Vivi, you lie, 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 Caro tells me.
I just smile.
Mother comes out to inspect our work on the Virgin.
Now, Mother says, now she looks more like Mary, most pure. Well done, girls. The Blessed Virgin is proud of you.
We've turned her into a white lady, Caro says, examining the statue.
Mother smiles.
The Blessed Virgin is not a colored person. She is the Mother of God. She is above even white people.
Then how come we had to rub all her brown skin off? Caro asks.
Caro doesn't believe everything grown-ups tell her. Caro makes up her own thoughts.
Little girls shouldn't ask so many questions, Carolina,
my mother tells my friend.
Bonjour,
Tainsy calls out, walking up our path, wearing a little sunsuit Genevieve's cousin on the bayou made her, all out of dishcloths. Niecy is with her, and they're holding hands, coming to play.
Hey, pals, Caro calls out. Hello, girls, Mother says when they reach the porch.
She reaches out to pat Teensy's pretty black curls, but Teensy pulls away. She doesn't like my mother ever since Mother spanked Teensy's bottom for taking all her clothes off at my 6th birthday party and dancing around buck naked singing to me.
Who is she?
Teensy asks, pointing to the statue.
That is the Blessed Virgin that these good little daughters of Mary have reclaimed. She was a tacky-colored Cuban with rouge like a harpy, but we took care of that, didn't we, girls?
Yes, ma'am, Caro and I say.
She used to be a gorgeous brown lady, I say.
Well, she sure looks like a spook now, Teensy says. How come y'all rub off her mouth?
What do you think, Denise?
Mother asks Niecy.
Did y'all use an eraser?
Niecy asks. My mother laughs.
No, dear. We started with Clorox and switched to turpentine.
Can we go play in the hammock now, please, ma'am? I ask.
Yes, you may, Mother answers. But first come and genuflect in front of our Holy Mother.
And so we all genuflect in front of the statue that looks like she saw something scary and lost all her color. Then Teensy spots the jewelry Mother took off the Virgin. She snatches it up so fast that Mother doesn't see her do it. That Teensy has quick hands, and she loves jewels.
So now it is me and Caro and Teensy and Niecy out on the side porch. Harrison, who works for us, just hung the big hammock Father brought me.
It's hanging from the blue ceiling of the porch, just outside the windows of Father's study.
None of y'all have a hammock like this. This one is Cuban.
I climb into the hammock and lay back facing the street.
Caro says, okay, you ready for me? I most certainly am, I tell her, and she scrambles into the hammock. Okay, Niecy, now you.
Niecy starts to climb in. She holds her dress so we can't see her panties.
Niecy, who do you think is going to look up your dress?
Teensy says.
I don't know, she says and rolls her eyes.
Then Teensy turns away from us and lifts up her dress so we can all see her underwear.
She shakes her butt in the direction of the street. She doesn't care who sees her. Panties on the porch, Teensy sings. Panties on the porch.
And Niecy is blushing. We love to embarrass her.
She's squinched in between Caro and me with her head at my end. I give her a little kiss on the cheek. Good, Niecy. Perfect fit, I tell her. Now, Teensy, you climb in and just get wherever you can fit.
Teensy gets in the hammock and just lays on top of us like we are her pillows.
Hey, get off me, I yell. Well, you said wherever, she laughs, and I push her, and she pushes back. Teensy always pushes back. If you push Niecy, she just says, I'm sorry. She is a relief sometimes after the rest of us.
Y'all cut it out, Niecy says.
Teensy, Caro says, scooch up here by my arm and put your legs over the side.
Teensy obeys her, snuggling in, and we are lying there like sardines in a mesh can. Through the spaces in hammock netting, you can see the porch floor, and through the porch floor, you can see slats of sunlight hitting the ground underneath the porch. I pull on the rope that Harrison has rigged so we can swing ourselves without getting up.
Oh, this is great, Carol says. And it is great, like we are in a big cradle together. I want a hammock like this, Teensy says. Well, then, tell your daddy to go to Cuba and get you one, I say.
I will. I will tell him this evening. I'll tell him to get me a Cuban Blessed Virgin, too, and I won't rub her face off either. I'll glue a pair of Maman's false eyelashes on her.
It is around 10 in the morning, and things are already hot. You can smell the morning sun hitting the grass and bringing up smells like lemon. I lean my head back and smell things wherever I am. To me, smells are like an invisible person that a lot of people forget is even there. I would rather lose my eyes than my sense of smell.
I can't wait till we have our Indian names, Teensy says.
Tonight is the night, Carol says,
and she closes her eyes and leans her head back in the hammock.
Niecy says, I hope it's not too dark in the woods.
Of course it'll be dark, Teensy says.
It will be dark as velvet, I say. Niecy's eyes grow big. Carol reaches out and grabs her like a monster out of nowhere, and she lets out a squeal. I can smell all Mother's flowers, and I can hear everything from my spot in the hammock. Someone beating rugs a few doors down. Lots and lots of birds, a fly buzzing, and Mr. Barnage's truck rattling down the street. I know the sound of all the automobiles and trucks in our neighborhood. Mother's honeysuckle mixes in with the smell of her gardenia and butterfly ginger and makes it smell so sweet out here on the porch. The rose of Montana vine that Mother has trained to climb across the porch ceiling is just dripping with flowers. She takes cuttings other people throw away and puts them into old coffee cans, and pretty soon they take over our porch and yard with blossoms. My mother can grow any flower in the world, and she knows all their names, too. Our whole yard is full of camellias. Mother's pride and joy, and she's got all kinds of roses and white and purple periwinkles and a potted kumquat that she brings inside during the winter so it won't freeze. If there is one thing my mama loves to do, it is work in the garden. Father and my grandmother Delia make fun of her. They call her a field hand. Niecy's mama always asks Mother to join the garden club, but Mother won't. She says her club is the Alta Society. Most of her flowers end up on the altar at Divine Compassion, not in our house. In the spring and summer, I live out on this porch that's surrounded by flowers. Come the warm weather, Mother and Delia's maid, Ginger, set up two beds at the end of the side porch with the mosquito netting that drops from the ceiling. Then Mother sets up a little night table and a boudoir lamp, and we all take turns sleeping out here. When my girlfriends come over to spend the night, Mother makes Pete and his pals move back to his room and lets us sleep out here. My favorite nights in the world are the nights I have my girlfriends over. That is when I sleep my best. Hardly a nightmare at all when my buddies are with me. Sleeping on the porch is the best thing in the world. You fall asleep with the sound of crickets, and you wake up with the sound of birds chirping. When you're still half asleep, they sound like a waterfall. If Huey Long himself came to visit, the porch is where I'd put him. We don't have servants fanning us here in Thornton, although sometimes we try to get Ginger, my grandmother's maid, to fan us with Delia's Vetiver hand fans. But she says, go soak your head, that cool you off. It is evening, and we all play cards after supper out on the porch with Pete and Mother. Father has business tonight, and so he didn't come home for supper again. My brother Pete teases us all the time. He keeps making up names for us. He calls Teensy Tinky and calls me Stinky. Carol he calls Carol Syrup, and Niecy he calls Kneesy, and points to his knee and then his eyes like he's playing charades. Pete is 2 years older than us and big and strong and has fox tails that fly from his bicycle. After four hands of crazy eights, Mother says it's time for bed. We all say goodnight and put on our gowns, and Mother comes out to make sure the mosquito netting is draped around our beds on the porch. She puts out a little pissoir so we won't have to troop all the way inside and up the stairs to powder our noses. We act so good and quiet that Mother thinks she has saints on her hands.
"Did y'all thank the Holy Lady for helping you through the day?" she asks.
"Yes, ma'am," we all call out from our beds. Mother is standing there on the other side of the mosquito net, already fingering her evening rosary.
"Well, then tell your guardian angels good night."
"Good night, angels," we say.
"Good night, little girls," Mother says.
We lie silently and watch her cross the gray planks of the porch and head back into the house. When she is out of sight, Caro says,
"We're not little girls. We are royal Indian maidens."
"Maybe instead of thanking the Holy Lady, y'all should apologize for wiping her face off," Teensy says. That makes us giggle.
"Y'all scrubbed off her lips and turpentined her skin," Teensy says.
"Imbecile, I bet those Cubans would have never sold that statue to your father if they knew y'all were going to ruin her looks."
"Shh," I say. "Mother might be in the living room listening. If we're quiet, then she'll think we're sound asleep and go on upstairs." We get quiet and just lie there for a moment with our bundles of supplies stashed beneath the beds.
"Now, are we going into the dark woods?"
Niecy murmurs.
"No," I whispered. "We have to wait till the whole house is asleep."
"How will we know?" she asks.
"I can tell," I say. "Houses sleep like people sleep. I can tell."
After a while, I climb out of bed to check. The coast is clear. We pull out our stash from under the beds, lift up our nightgowns, and take turns rubbing a raw onion all over our bodies so the mosquitoes won't carry us away. We're lucky it's been a dry summer so far, or we'd never be able to go into the woods at night without getting bitten to death. Then we sneak off the porch and into the backyard.
"Stealthily,"
Caro says. We cut across the Munson's alley, walk a few hundred yards, take a deep breath, and then slip into the woods. We have Pete's flashlight and a half moon for light. I finger the piece of paper in the pocket of my nightgown. It holds our tribal story. I am the mistress of legend tonight.
"What if we run into a camp of hobos?"
Niecy asks. Caro is holding the light since she's the tallest. She also carries a rucksack with some pieces of wood in it. She's the mistress of fire.
"The hobos are closer to the railroad tracks," I say.
"Father says his friends at the police station have already run all the hobos out of Thornton," says Teensy. "Mama and he got in a big fight about it."
"Mama fed some hobos a few days ago, right on our back steps," Niecy says. "But I am not supposed to talk to hobos. Just feed them."
"Hobos keep coming round your house because your mother won't erase the hobo mark, even though the mayor told everyone they should," I say. "Mother only feeds them once a week now, or else she says we'll end up joining them as much as Pete eats." Niecy is the only one of us who knows how to cook, so she has brought fudge in a paper sack. She is the mistress of refreshment. Teensy, the mistress of dance, has got four empty oatmeal boxes in her sack for our drums, and I've got the needle. We keep walking until we are on the edge of the little bayou that runs back behind Teensy's house. We all help Caro build a small fire. Caro is a swell fire builder, good as a boy. Mr. Bob taught her, and she taught me. When our fire gets going, we all sit around it. I gaze into its flames and begin my telling the story of the divine tribe of Louisiana Yayas.
The secret history of the Louisiana Yayas. Long before the white man showed up, the mighty tribe of Yayas, a band of women strong and true and beautiful, roamed the great state of Louisiana.
Leopards slept with us, and bears fed us honey from their paws, and fish jumped up into our hands because they wanted to be our food. The trees were so thick that we could travel from New Orleans to Shreveport on treetop, and we did. Hundreds of Ya-Ya Indians traveling on the tops of trees. Our mother was a black she-ape named Lola, who found us in a cave at the beginning of time and raised us like her very own children. We loved her like a mother. People didn't mess with the tribal Ya-Ya sisters. But then, Hurricane Zandra, the hugest hurricane known to man, came and ripped all the trees out by their roots and turned all the streams into rivers and killed everybody, including our mother, Lola. Only four of us survived. Everywhere we turned, evil alligators tried to eat us. There was nowhere to hide because those alligators could crawl from water to land and be just as mean in either place. We were starving so bad that our bones were sticking out and we didn't sleep for 40 days. Finally, we were so weak, we just gave up. The alligators rejoiced and crawled up to where we lay helpless. They crawled so close that we looked right into their ugly old eyes and saw the light of the moon reflected. We tried everything we knew, but our strength was gone. Then, from behind the moon, came a gorgeous lady. We could see her from where we lay on our deathbeds. She looked down and saw we were hanging by an eyelash over the canyon of doom. And the moon lady shot silver rays from her eyes so hot and mighty that those alligators were burned to a crisp right in their sleazy tracks. Fried those ugly critters sunny side up right there on the road. We could hear them sizzling. And the moon lady said, "You are my daughters, in whom I am well pleased. I will always keep my divine eyes peeled for you." We, the Ya-Ya's, had lost our jungle home, and our town does not realize we are royal. But secretly, we all know our history, and we will be loyal to our tribe forever and ever, in sickness and in health, as it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, the end. Then I look at everyone in the eyes and say, "Now it is official. We are, from here on out, to be known as Ya-Ya's." And everybody starts clapping.
"Some of that kind of sounds like it came from the Bible," Niecy says.
"Do not question the mistress of legend," I say.
"Yeah," Teensy chimed in, "the Bible doesn't own those words."
"Never mind," Niecy says. "Would y'all care for some fudge?"
"Why, thank you, mistress of refreshment," I say, and we all bite into big chunks of chocolate pecan fudge. "I hate those old alligators," Carol says, then looks in the direction of the bayou. Niecy says, "y'all don't think there are any alligators in this bayou, do you?"
"My mom put a gree-gree on all the alligators behind our house," Teensy says. "We don't have to worry. My ma is the one who gave us our name. She's the one always saying, 'Gumbo Ya-Ya, Gumbo Ya-Ya.'"
"That's us," Niecy says.
"Exactement," Teensy says. "From here on out to the end of time, we will be known as the Ya-Ya's. Nobody can take our name away."
Then Teensy whips the empty oatmeal boxes out of her paper sack, and we all beat on them. And while we drum, we yell out to the night and the woods and the fire that we are now the Yah-Yahs. Then Niecy, the mistress of names, formally gives all of us our Yah-Yah Indian names that we have chosen ourselves. Mine is Queen Dancing Creek, Caro's is Duchess Soaring Hawk, and Niecy's is Countess Singing Cloud. Each time Niecy pronounces our new names, she sprinkles us with water from an old RC bottle with a hole punched in the top that she borrowed from her mama's ironing board. Teensy has been keeping her Indian name a secret from us for weeks. Finally, when it's her turn, she hands Niecy an envelope, all secret-like. Niecy opens the envelope, looking for Teensy's name, and when she sees it, her eyes get big as Popeyes, and she starts blushing from head to foot. For a minute, Niecy doesn't say a word. You can hear a whippoorwill calling from far away somewhere, and little crackling sounds from Caro's fire. Then Niecy turns back to Teensy, who is grinning even bigger than ever. I now name you Princess Naked as a Jaybird. The princess goes wild. Ha-cha-cha! Teensy screams and starts spinning around in circles. She rips off her nightgown and makes us take off ours, too. Niecy tries to chicken out, so Teensy and I have to take off her gown for her. This might be a mortal sin, y'all, she says. Yeah, I tell her, a royal Yah-Yah mortal sin. Everybody ready for ceremonial paint? Teensy asks with one of her bad looks. What? We all say. This is not in the program, but the Yah-Yah tribe plays things by ear. Teensy reaches into her sack and pulls out a bunch of Genevieve's Max Factor of Hollywood tubes and pots of color and pencils and lipsticks and, oh, all kinds of lovely little items that Mother thinks are vulgar. Teensy hands me a pot of red rouge. Caro gets a pot of brown color. Niecy gets lipstick, and Teensy has the pencils. We take turns drawing on each other until we could pass for full-blooded Injuns. Red and brown streaks across our foreheads and black stars on our cheeks. And then Teensy has the idea of painting our stomachs and chests, too. I draw a black line down the center of my body, and I rub lipstick all over one side and leave the other side regular skin color. Teensy draws lipstick in circles around her titties. Niecy, Teensy says, take your hands away from your titties. We've all seen them before. They are nothing new. If that isn't enough, old Teensy pulls out the necklaces and earrings that Mother made us take off the Negro Cuban Virgin. I call out the secret Yah-Yah jewels lost all these centuries and only recently found by Princess Naked as a Jaybird, world-famous lady archaeologist. We all scramble to put on the jewels, and pretty soon we are following Teensy, all slapping our thighs and running and whooping, hi-ho, silver. Then we stop dancing to prick our thumbs with the sewing needle. The mistress of fire holds the needle under the flame of a match, and then we each take turns letting Caro draw a tiny bead of blood. Raising our hands above our heads, we rub our thumbs together and recite our oath. I am a member of the royal and true tribe of Yah-Yahs. No one can come between us, and no one can break away, because now we have the same blood. I do solemnly swear to be loyal to my sister Yah-Yahs and to love and look out for them and never forsake them through thick and thin until I take my last human breath. But of course, instead of breath, Teensy goes and says breast. She says, until I take my last human breast. And she says it loud, just to be bad. My heart is beating so hard I can see it move my chest up and down. And I can see the same thing in Teensy's and Caro's chests. All our eyes are shining. Now, Teensy instructs us, everybody lick the blood off your thumbs. I look at her. This wasn't in the plan. Teensy goes ahead and licks, though, and so I do, too. I flick my tongue lightly over the dot of blood on my thumb. "Now, swallow," I tell everybody. The words just flying out of my mouth without me even thinking them. And we all swallow the tiny drops of each other's blood, like Holy Communion, but it's our blood, not Jesus Christ. When I have babies, they'll have Caro and Teensy's and Niecy's blood. That will make us all related. And when I get old and die, as long as the heart of one Yaya is still pumping blood, I'll still be alive. Our blood is all mixed into one. Then Niecy says, real soft, "Can I do my closing divine walnut ceremony?" I had forgotten all about the surprise Niecy said she had for the ending. We follow her to the edge of the bayou, and out of her bag, she pulls 4 walnut halves and hands one to each of us. Then she gives us candle stubs and has us light them. "Now, drip a little bitty wax inside the shell," she tells us, "and stick your candle stub in there." We are all surprised at Niecy coming up with this. Every time I think I know my friends, they surprise me. They are full of secrets I will never know. You can hear the scratch of the kitchen match against the box and the little poof sound it makes when it ignites. We each light our candles and watch Niecy. She bends down and gently lowers her walnut shell with its lit candle until it rests on top of the water. She gives the shell a tiny little push, and we all watch it float a little ways onto the dark water of the bayou. Then we each do the same thing, until there are 4 walnut halves bearing tiny lights out on the water that look like little ferry boats. The beauty of it makes me want to cry. We are holding hands, and we are high and mighty Yayas, descendants of royal blood, which we will pass on down through many generations. Back at my house, the white statue of the Cuban Virgin is still sitting on the porch. The porch light is shining down on her, and June bugs flicker around the bulb, making little crackling sounds. The 4 of us stop dead in our tracks. We kneel down in front of Mary, and Teensy hands us items from her bag. Caro, Teensy, and I take the very same brand of dark beauty contouring makeup that Carol Lombard and Norma Shearer use and begin to smear it on the face, hands, and feet of the turpentined Holy Lady. The makeup feels waxy, and it smells like Genevieve's dressing room. Under my fingers, I can feel the smooth wood of the Virgin. After we color her skin brown again, we dip into the rouge pots and color her cheeks. We apply blue eyeshadow to her eyelids and to the folds of her gown, and then line her lips with lipstick that reads harem red on the bottom of the tube. After that, we remove her jewels from our royal selves and put them back on the Virgin. When we're done, we stand back in silence to admire our handiwork. Niecy, who has still not touched the Virgin, steps forward and kneels at the